Hi, I'm Marisa McClellan, creator of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, a freelance writer focused on food and health.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk shop with obsessed home cooks everywhere. This week, we're talking about scallion pancakes, halouski, and our current cooking crushes. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week.
A reader sent us this article. I can't remember whether it was sent to both of us or just me.
I think it was just you, because I actually read this independently. And when you put it in the spreadsheet, I was like, oh, that's fun. I've already read that piece.
Oh, well, it's a gripping investigation of the great bucatini shortage of 2020.
I really enjoyed this piece because it treats a pasta shortage like it's big news, but it actually has like intrigue. There are things happening, and bucatini, admittedly, a good pasta cut. So
I also like it. Did you notice there was a shortage?
I didn't, mostly because when I was buying pasta, I was buying it at like Trader Joe's or Costco, and bucatini is not one of the cuts that they carry normally. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't on my radar. But I will say that after I read this piece, I was at Rittenhouse Market, which is one like the little city grocery store a few blocks from me, and I happened to look for it, and they had it, so I bought a box.
Dan has this weird aversion to strand pastas, spaghetti, fettuccine, bucatini, and all the long strand pastas.
Interesting. So
it's very frustrating. But anyway,
I love a linguine personally.
I love all the pastas, but I do feel like strand pastas have a special place in the world that sometimes I make him eat them, but rarely. So, yeah, this is like a long, dramatic article with several compelling points. Do you want to explain the bucatini shortage to us?
Well, it's in her. So the article is written by Rachel Handler, and her investigation kind of turns up three reasons why there has been a bucatini shortage. One is simply that pasta has been in great demand during the pandemic, as we all know. And bucatini is a more complex cut to make because it's not just a strand, it's got a hole in the center. So it takes a little bit more in terms of manufacturing. And so they have switched to things that are easier to make, which makes sense. But then it turns out that there was also some issues with the enriching, that the FDA has certain requirements for how much imported pasta is fortified with different vitamins and minerals, and bucatini was coming short on iron, I think is what it said. And then finally, there is an issue. So some people have been using bucatini as straws because of wanting to keep plastic single-use straws out of the environment, thinking bucatini is a more environmentally friendly thing to use as a straw format. You know, it has a hole in the center. But
I have an observation about that, though.
Yeah.
I can imagine that as like a cocktail straw, but like the hole is very small.
I know, it's not very big. But I mean, maybe a cocktail straw or like someone's using two or three of them. I've also seen pasta as coffee stirrers at coffee bars as a way to not use up a wooden stirrer or a plastic one. So, I mean, it mimics like a little cocktail or coffee stirrer straw the most effectively. But the issue there is that it's a product designed to be cooked and used in a non-cooked context. It can actually, there's a small chance of foodborne illness if you eat raw pasta. So those were the three kind of primary issues that she teased out of her investigation.
Yeah, it was a good read.
Yeah.
It's definitely hard to imagine anybody like crunching down on their raw bucatini also.
No. Well, I mean, but as we all know, things get hung up for crazy reasons.
Right. Right. And I feel like the article implied there was some kind of sabotage between brands.
It did. It did. the FDA doesn't necessarily go out looking for issues, but then, you know, someone reported their issue with the fortification. So,
yeah. Who knows? I mean, of course, we'll post the link in the show notes. And I would also ask you all out there, if you have a favorite bucatini recipe, tell us what it is, because I would like to have it. I want to enjoy eating some bucatini now that I've read this article, but I feel like I could use some recipe inspiration.
Yeah, I'm off. I'm game for that too. All right, so Joy, tell me about the scallion pancakes you're having for dinner.
Well, I want to. This actually is the thing that I made for Christmas. Uh-huh. Dan and I decided we were going to do like a takeout Chinese food at home, and I wanted to make it fun and special. So I was thinking of things that we get at restaurants that we don't usually make at home. But I also didn't want to like take on something really hard and complex, like making dumplings. I love homemade dumplings, but it is, first of all, I'm bad at folding them, and it's like very, very tedious.
Yeah.
The scallion pancake is something that Dan and I often will order at a Chinese restaurant, and I was looking in how to make them, and they're not that hard. Have you ever made them?
I haven't, but I somehow feel like I've watched a lot of videos of people making them, like they're often on Instagram, and it doesn't look that hard. It just looks like multiple steps.
The thing is, like, a scallion pancake is very flaky with layers of fat and flour, you know?
Yeah.
Sort of like a croissant or whatever. So my thought was that they would be difficult to make on the order of, like, a laminated pastry, which I guess isn't that – I don't like doing it. It's time-consuming. You know, it's just – and I think it's pretty hard. For whatever reason, that's what I thought it would be like. But it actually isn't really like that. You make like a really simple hot water and flour dough with salt in it. That's mm-hmm. it. You mix it up and then you let it sit for, I think, only 30 minutes. Then you roll it out into a large round, like 10 inches around, I think, kind of like a pizza. And then you brush on a mixture of toasted sesame oil, and the recipe I used had some flour mixed in with it, but not all recipes do that. So you brush that on your big round, mm-hmm. and then you sprinkle it with tons of scallions, and then you roll it up like a jelly roll kind of.
Yeah.
And then you take your long jelly roll log and coil it up like a snail sort of.
Yeah.
And then you basically flatten that. Then you take your rolling pin and you roll that out into a smaller round, like maybe 8 or 9 inches. And then you fry it up in a little bit of oil. And wow, it's just like you get at a restaurant. Actually, even better.
For some reason, I thought it had more rolling steps. That is easy.
Yes, very easy. Very, very easy. The only problem was we ate so much of it. Like, I think the recipe we made served 6, and we ate like 75% of it the first night we made it, along with all the other stuff we made. So, but I think I would be more able to resist next time.
Well, and it sounds like maybe making a half batch might also be a good way to go.
Yeah, that's true. The recipe I used made 2 pretty big scallion pancakes, so like one would be definitely enough. I will absolutely. The other thing, though, I think is you could put them in the freezer, either when they're rolled out into the pancake or after you've cooked them, and then just reheat them.
Uh-huh.
So it might be worth it to just make it all and then save some for later. Because instead of eating so much of it, like just a couple of wedges with whatever you're making for dinner would be a treat, a nice treat.
That sounds great.
So I know in the future, someday, when we get to be together in person and like you can bring things to a party or a potluck or something, I will definitely be making these for other people because they're really fun.
I can't wait. I want to eat your scallion pancakes.
Soon, or eventually.
6 months from now, maybe? Who knows?
So that's just a little bit of, I just wanted to talk to everybody about that it was really fun when I did it over the holidays, and I definitely will do it again. I referred to 3 recipes primarily, the one on Simply Recipes, the one on Serious Eats, and the Cook's Illustrated recipe. And I will post links to the 3 of those in the show notes for today.
Sounds good. In case
you want to try your hand at scallion pancakes. Do you like them? Do you get them at restaurants?
I enjoy a good scallion pancake. Sometimes they're so greasy that they make my stomach hurt. So it just depends.
I feel you. The homemade version is not that way. I said to Dan, these are better than a lot of scallion pancakes we've had at restaurants.
Wow.
Because they're not greasy, like you make them as crisp as you want.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Now I want to try making them. I bet they'd be good baby food.
I bet your babies would like them.
Yeah.
I mean, carbs and fat. Do they like oniony things?
Yeah. They're actually pretty, they haven't hit a picky phase yet, which is amazing. So
cool.
I think they'd dig. I mean, they love pizza, so they'd love a scallion pancake.
I think they would. Let's get them on the Asian food train early.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I say.
Absolutely. So speaking of comforting carbs, I busted out a recipe or a technique earlier this week that is something I hadn't had in a long time. And for all of our love of cabbage, I'm surprised we haven't talked about before, which is halluski, which if you don't know what that is, it's the Polish word for a cabbage and noodle dish. And it's something I didn't grow up eating, but it's got to be 15 years ago or so now. I was in Pittsburgh with my friend Cindy, where she grew up, and we were at an arts festival, the big Pittsburgh Arts Festival. And she was so excited because one of the food stands at the arts festival was selling halluski. And I was like, I've never heard of this. What is it? And her grandmother used to make it for her. And it's basically a super buttery cabbage and egg noodle dish. And you start with an onion, you kind of brown it up a little bit, get it nice and sweet. And then you add cabbage, you cook it till it's tender, you throw in egg noodles. A lot of the recipes I looked at had a ton of butter. We're talking like a full stick of butter for the, you know, for a serving that, you know, a dish that would serve like six people. So when I made it, of course, I tried to make it slightly healthier. And so I actually ended up just using the sunflower oil from the Susquehanna Mills because, you know, Scott is back on doing Weight Watchers and counting his points. And so instead of using a stick of butter, I used 2 tablespoons of sunflower oil, and it was still delicious. And so
can I ask you just a quick Weight Watchers procedural question?
Yes.
Do you know, does 2 tablespoons of sunflower oil clock in with fewer points than 2 tablespoons of butter?
You know, I haven't done the math, but
just curious.
I think that it might because of the saturation.
That's what I was.
Yeah.
I would hope that it does if the goal of the program is health instead of like just purely weight loss. But anyway, proceed. Sorry about
and
that.
So,
you know, I'm curious all the time about what's happening.
I don't know the nitty gritty, but I believe that when I use like a heart healthy oil, it does give like it's 1 or 2 points less across the dish. So I used the sunflower oil. I cut an onion into half moons, but into kind of ribbons. So across the, as if you were doing fajitas, because I feel like that just gives a better texture for this kind of dish, and then cut that in half. So it was sort of like, ribbons that were in half. And then, I browned that in a hot pan, and then I started adding my cabbage. And for me, the trick, so I have made this over the years because I knew I was going to talk about it. I looked up some recipes to kind of, cross-reference my technique. The thing I like to do that a lot of the recipes don't do is I kind of cook my cabbage in stages. So some of it I cook all the way. I cook it super soft. And then some I reserve and add at the end so that it's a little bit more textural.
So crunchy.
So that you have...
Or crisp.
Yeah, crisp. Not crunchy necessarily, but some is a little bit crisper than other bits because it can be very texturally one note with the noodles and the soft cooked cabbage if you cook all of it all the way. Whereas if you save some for the end, you get a little bit of crisp texture. It's just a nice variation in something that could be all kind of the same texture if you're not careful.
Is it more noodles or more cabbage?
I do it more cabbage. So I did a full, like a 3-pound head of cabbage to 6 ounces of noodles. But still, it's so good. It is so good. Even without butter, but with lots of salt and pepper, onion, cabbage and noodles, it's delicious. And I use the eggless egg noodles or the no yolks version, again, because of the point situation. But
I can see that package in my mind's eye.
Yeah, I did some research knowing I was going to talk to you about this, and that there doesn't seem to be any vegan version of an egg noodle, but I would imagine
there must be.
I mean, I couldn't find a packaged version, but I'm sure you could use sort of like what you're going for is a kind of a wide, short, ribbony noodle. So like you could cut up fettuccine, like a vegan fettuccine, something like that. But it's just such a nice, soothing, comforting dish, especially in cold January, to have, you know, tender, you know, it, I use just enough oil to kind of make everything a little bit shiny and glossy and slippery, but not so much that it tastes oily. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It's so good. Mm-hmm. And we ate it with turkey meatloaf. Tonight I'm going to roast some chicken and we're going to use the leftovers with that. And it's nice too because it's a vegetable and a carb all in one.
Yeah, sounds pretty good.
I think you'd like it, Joy.
Well, anything, carbs and cabbage together? Yes, please. I've never heard that word before today, haluski.
Yeah, it's the Polish name for it.
Does it have other names? I don't know.
I'm sure my family, my mom's family is Hungarian and Ukrainian Jews. And so I'm sure that between those two cultures, there was some, you know, Yiddish name for mm-hmm. this dish, but I don't know it.
Hmm. Well,
delicious.
I think I'm into it. So shall we move on to our current cooking crushes? I was actually thinking about my top one when you were talking about the wide flat vegan noodle.
Uh-huh. Because
I would say my biggest culinary crush at the moment is Isa Chandra Moskowitz, who is perhaps best known for her YouTube show from, I think, the 90s, Post Punk Kitchen. Or did we even have YouTube in the 90s?
I think it was
public access.
Well, and I remember she was on YouTube and making videos, certainly when Scott and I were doing Fork You. So back in like 2005, 2006, she was on the internet a lot.
And her books are her Vegan with a Vengeance, Veganomicon. She's kind of like a big feature of vegan cooking in America, I would
feel
say.
Like she's one of the most popular vegan, or at least the longest serving vegan educators in the U.S.
During the pandemic, I have accumulated almost all of her books. And in one of the books, she recommends cutting lasagna noodles into like a wide flat shape, which I think would work in the dish that you're talking about. But her books are full of genius ideas like that and great recipes. So like I've been 110% on the Isa Chandra Moskowitz train. Her most recent book is called Isa Does It. And it has a recipe in there, some basics called, she calls it Melty Maz, which is a very, very, very simple, like cashew type cheese for things.
Yeah.
And like, I honestly make some more complicated vegan cheese type things, but my mom, who's just sort of trying to like get into more plant-based cooking and loves pizza, you know, she's not really up for the more complicated version. So I sent her that recipe and she made it and she loved it.
That's great.
I think it only has like five ingredients. It's like cashews, nutritional yeast, miso, and water. Or, you know, it's very easy to make. So I really, really, really love cooking from her books. Another thing that should we alternate? Let's alternate.
Sure. So one of the people I've really been enjoying following lately is Claire Thompson. Her Instagram handle is 5 o'clock apron. I think I've mentioned her on the show before. She is a UK-based food writer, cookbook author. So she's written several family cookbooks, and I've been finding them really useful and helpful in trying to find interesting things to make for my boys because they're eating a lot and, kind of finding things that are foods that everybody can eat and I can kind of pull out things for them. And, you know, so she's just been giving me a lot of ideas. I've made some risotto recently, thinking, you know, not really thinking about it as good sort of toddler food, but then a recipe in her book made me realize, oh yeah, like a pea risotto is perfect toddler food. And then she's also, because they're back on lockdown in the UK, she is making Instagram stories and Instagram TV video cooking videos from her kitchen with her girls. And that's just kind of fun to watch. So I've been enjoying what she's doing.
Cool. I have been watching the Wicked Foods YouTube channel lately. That's from chefs Derek and Chad Sarno. And I'll tell you how I discovered this. I mentioned on the podcast a while back that I had signed up for online vegan cooking school through Ruby.
Yeah.
And I started doing it. And at some point early on in the first week, I was like, this is insane. I already know all this stuff. Like, definitely. I was finding some of the course material was linking out to blog posts on like Dr. Michael Greger's website, who is a sort of a prominent plant-based doctor. And I've actually, not only am I familiar with his website, I've read all of his books.
Oh, wow.
And then like, you know, assignments are like roast vegetables. What's the difference between blanching and parboiling? And I was like, get a hold of yourself, Joy. You know, like you spent a not insignificant number of dollars on this and like you can get a refund because you already know the stuff. So I did.
Good.
And then I was like, but there are things in this course that I still wanted to learn. And I was like, I can probably learn them some other way. And one of those things was fresh vegan pasta.
Uh-huh.
And so I was Googling it, and one of the people who runs the school is Chad Sarno, who I just mentioned. He's behind the Wicked Foods YouTube channel and the Wicked Healthy Cookbook. And so, like, when you know it, there's, like, a 40-minute YouTube video of him demonstrating the pasta. And I was like, I can learn the things that I wanted to learn from this course without it. And then that sent me down the rabbit hole of his whole YouTube channel. So I was watching videos for things complicated and simple, and it was like I found it very inspiring. He made me make up a big blender of peanut sauce one day. Uh-huh. And if you ever want to eat a whole head of cabbage, like all you really need is a large quantity of peanut sauce, because peanut sauce and cabbage are terrific together. So that's another one, a pandemic food crush of mine at the moment.
Another person that I've been really enjoying is Christina Gill. Her Instagram stories are just so good.
I must also follow her because that's so familiar to me.
She's a food writer. There was some scandal around the fact that she had co-written a cookbook with someone, and her name was taken off of a lot of it. And so that might be how.
I think it's Katie Parla's book, right? Yeah. She writes about Rome.
Yes. And it was supposed to be a co-write, and Christina Gill was sort of erased from it in a lot of ways, which wasn't right or fair. That's how she came to my attention. So I've been following her since that happened. But her Instagram stories are this really fun combination of kind of guilty pleasure foods, which is a phrase I probably should get out of my vocabulary, because why does it have to be guilty pleasure? Anyway, I'm trying to take that kind of language out of my food talk. One of our listeners brought up some of that to us recently, and so I'm working on it.
Food is not a moral issue.
Yes, exactly. But really indulgent things like a hamburger that's dripping with cheese, and then it's combined with some politics and dogs, which is a trio of topics that I really enjoy. So, you know, beautiful food images, a little politics, and dogs. Those are things that I, you know, will always, say yes to. So I've been enjoying what she posts and what she shares. So that's another one that is top of my list right now.
I am still into Canadian vegan food blogger and Instagrammer Sam Turnbull. Her blog is It Doesn't Taste Like Chicken. It's true. I have not had 100% success with 100% of her recipes, but I have some real favorites from her repertoire. I made her spinach artichoke dip again for this holiday season, and it's just terrific. I have been her recipe for a veggie burger is my favorite that I've ever tried.
Wow.
It's like a combination between like a seitan burger and like a more traditional veggie burger based on lentils and beets. So it's like half seitan, half vegetables and lentils, but It just really works. It's so good. Dan and I are both like really blown away by how much we like them, better than any prepared veggie burger we've ever bought or any other one we've ever made.
Wow, that's really saying something.
So, I have mixed feelings, but it's mostly just a crush that I have on Sam.
So I'm going to switch to food items, since I see on your list you've got food items too. I am hitting frozen blueberries real hard right now.
Are you finding the wild ones?
I have gotten them sometimes. I've also just been enjoying the 3-pound bags of frozen blueberries from Costco. They're big and juicy and sweet. I also had I just finished up the frozen blueberries that I had from when I bought 20 pounds of blueberries last summer, and I froze a bunch of them.
Mm.
So those were the ones I was working through first, and they've been great. One of my favorite things for breakfast is I fill the bottom of my bowl with frozen blueberries, and then I pour hot oatmeal on top, and the oatmeal, you know, defrost the blueberries. The blueberries release all of their purple goodness into the oatmeal. You stir it up. It's the right temperature. And then I put some toasted slivered almonds on top. And that is just about my favorite breakfast right now.
Sounds good. Do you put no sweetener on at all?
The blueberries are enough for me. Years ago, I trained myself to not eat sweetened oats. Like, it's got to be almost 20 years ago now. When I was in my early mid 20s, I would make steel cut oats and take them to work with me, and I would just eat them plain. And it was part like a dieting trick or whatever, but it really allowed me to have a taste for oats that didn't have sweetener on it.
Cool. I put both raisins in mine and then also a little bit of maple syrup because
I mean, the blueberries are quite sweet, you know, just on their own. So it's not like it's totally,
Never been able to get into the savory oatmeal, which to me, like plain oatmeal is like a middle ground between sweet and savory oatmeal. I think there's really just one more thing that I want to mention from my list, which is the air fryer.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Local Mouthful listener Denise, for sending me such a generous and awesome gift that has really brightened my pandemic. I would have never in a million years gotten it for myself, but I use it almost every day and I could not love it more.
Wow, that's a real ringing endorsement.
If you're only two people and you eat tofu, I really think that it's like worth the counter space it takes up because it's the simplest and best way to make tofu that I have ever found.
That's awesome.
Also kale chips. You can even like get a basically like a fried nut. You know how like if you get snack peanuts from Planters or whatever, they're like fried basically. Mm-hmm. If you just film your peanuts with oil and stick them in the air fryer, then you get that exact same thing. Like
really,
I'm still finding new things to do with it all the time.
I remember several years ago I was visiting friend of the show Emily Pastor when I was on book tour, and she was writing an air fryer book while I stayed with her at one point, and she did her crispy chickpeas in the air fryer, and that was revelatory. Those were so good.
Yeah. I did crispy chickpeas in there one time, but I think I didn't leave them in long enough because they didn't get as crispy as I wanted, but I was kind of in a hurry. Anyway, I'm sure that will be a future project for me.
I'm sure it will. Is it time to move on to what we're loving?
Do you have anything else?
Not working. I can have one more thing, which another food thing that I've been really enjoying is Ezekiel bread, which I know some people, it's one of those things you either love it or hate it. It's the bread that's made from sprouted grains. And so it's not really, there's no flour involved, but it's so nutty and ends up being really light. And I just love it as peanut butter toast. Like those are the things I'm eating for breakfast right now is oatmeal with blueberries or peanut butter Ezekiel toast. Like those are my two breakfasts right now, and I love them both.
Well, speaking of breakfast, that's what you tossed on here for what we're loving.
It is. So I wanted to talk about cooking your oats overnight. I'm doing it in my rice cooker right now, and it is bringing such joy to my mornings. So my rice cooker has a timer. And a porridge setting. So you can set it up the night before, plug in the time where you want it to be done, and walk away. And so you do that, and then you come in the next morning, and your oats are cooked. And you can do it with steel-cut oats. You can do it with regular rolled oats. And I'm sure you could do it with any combination of grains if you wanted to make some sort of multi-grain cereal. But it made me realize, like, if you don't have a rice cooker that does this, a slow cooker also works beautifully for this sort of thing. You can just set it to go overnight and stay warm all night. But the concept of setting something up the night before and then having a warm breakfast that morning is so good, so nice, such a treat. It's been real cold. I don't want to get up in the morning. I have two little people who make me. But knowing that breakfast is already made helps kind of cushion that blow a little bit.
I can imagine. I make Dan get out of bed and make breakfast.
Yeah, well, that I make breakfast for everyone, so that would not work.
Well, I think that about does it for this episode of Local Mouthful.
Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.